government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is about regulating the transmission of money. Presently, money transmitters must go regulator to regulator, explain their business, and become licensed in 53 states and territories. That model presents obvious inefficiencies and, some argue, stifles innovation and economic growth. On the other hand, a case can be made that these efforts are necessary for consumer protection. Our Free Lunch Podcast guest today, Peter Van Valkenburg, argues that by changing the current approach to licensing money transmitters, we can both promote financial technology innovation and enjoy its benefits while minimizing harms. This approach is outlined in a paper that Peter authored called The Need for a Federal Alternative to State Money Transmission Licensing, released just yesterday by CoinCenter, and which is shared on the RTP social media pages. Peter is director of research at CoinCenter, the leading nonprofit research and advocacy group focused on public policy issues facing cryptocurrency technologies such as Bitcoin. Peter writes the center's public regulatory comments and helps shape its research agenda. He's testified before Congress, briefed staff and members of the EU Parliament, and educated policymakers and regulatory staff around the world on the subject of cryptocurrency regulation and decentralized computing systems. Previously, he was a Google Policy Fellow and collaborated with various digital rights organizations on projects related to privacy, surveillance, and digital copyright law. He's a graduate of NYU Law, as well as a self-taught designer and coder. If you'd like to learn more about Peter or CoinCenter, visit coincenter.org. In a moment, I'll turn the floor over to Peter. Before I do, I remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Peter will answer questions after his remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the Q&A period. And with that, Peter, thanks for being with us today as our Free Lunch Podcast guest. You have the floor, sir.
Thanks so much, Devin. Thank you for inviting us. Not to give another plug for CoinCenter after that excellent introduction, but we've been doing this focused on Bitcoin policy, Ethereum cryptocurrency policy since 2014. We're in DC, and we've got a ton of public resources on our website, coincenter.org. So if this conversation interests you, please visit our materials as well. I think you'll find them interesting. So today I want to talk about a new report that CoinCenter released yesterday. Focused on state-by-state money transmission licensing, what it does to innovation, what it does to innovative businesses, why it's inefficient, and how there are reasonable alternatives that we'd like to see potentially at least contemplated, get the conversation started, and maybe eventually made into law. So I also want to frame this conversation given some recent news items in the Bitcoin, Ethereum public policy space. Many of you who are familiar with these technologies may know that some federal regulators are starting to take more of an interest in them. In particular, the Securities Exchange Commission, because of its investor protection remit, and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, because of its investor protection remit in the commodities area as opposed to securities. The chairman of those two agencies, Chairman Giancarlo of the CFTC and Chairman Clayton of the SEC, are going to testify this coming Tuesday before Congress on the subject of cryptocurrencies, pretty much exclusively. And that's kind of fascinating. And if you told me that when I started my work here at Coin Center in 2014, I'd say, oh gosh, that's either really good news or really bad news. And I think it's mostly good news, and we'll see how that testimony goes. But I bring it up because they wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week, jointly, that probably previews a lot of what they'll say in their testimony. And one of the big things that they say in that op-ed is that digital currency exchanges are currently regulated as money transmitters at the states, as we're going to discuss, and that that state-by-state method of regulating those exchanges as a policy matter is probably in need of a revisit. And they kind of left it there with a dot, dot, dot. And honestly, at Coin Center, we were quite excited about that because we happen, fortuitously, to have been working on this report, revisiting state-by-state money transmission regulation and seeing if there are better alternatives. So with that as a preface, I'll just dive into basically what we say in the paper. So the first thing to point out is that money transmitters, unlike banks and unlike, say, some other financial services companies, are regulated predominantly by the states. And those regulations focus on consumer protection pretty much exclusively. So, you know, a money transmitter is somebody who takes custody of some valuables for a person and then, at the person's direction, sends them to some other person, Western Union, MoneyGram, things like this. And now it also includes virtual currency or digital currency companies because in many cases the state law is broadly written and includes any kind of money or monetary equivalent. And I think it's hard to argue that Bitcoin isn't a substitute or an equivalent to money. And Bitcoin exchanges, like, for example, Coinbase or Zappo, they do take Bitcoins from people. They take custody over them, and they, at the direction of their customer, move them around. So it's not an insensible thing to say that it looks like, at least according to many state statutes, Bitcoin companies fit into the money transmission licensing framework. Now, as I said, those laws are directed at protecting consumers. So Western Union could, in theory, take your $500 that you were sending to the Philippines and just not send it to the Philippines and run away with it. And this actually happened, not Western Union, of course, but some small money transmitters in various states back in the 1980s were basically just operating, you know, fraudulently. And they were stealing money from especially vulnerable populations. And one of the big responses we saw state by state was the creation of a licensing regime that says you're not allowed to do this business until you first check in with the regulator because of the risk that you steal money from your customers. And so every state money transmission statute, and there are 53 states and territories that do licensing. The only one that doesn't is Montana. And I like Montana for that, although there are reasonable questions about consumer protection in Montana, I suppose. But all the 53 states and territories that regulate money transmission, the statutes look relatively the same. So some salient points. They're all permission-based. In other words, you're simply not allowed to do that activity until you get a license. They all apply extraterritorially, and that means that it doesn't matter if your business is based in Iowa. If you have customers in Alabama, you're going to need a license in Alabama. So these things, they cross state lines, these laws, and you will be subject to the laws of any state where you have customers. So if you are an internet business like a Coinbase or a Western Union nowadays, you're going to need licenses in 53 states and territories. And that's not an easy thing to get. Aside from being permission-based and extraterritorial, they're also rules-based. So these don't create flexible, judicially administered standards against fraud. They create very strict compliance obligations. You have to submit information for a background check before you're allowed to get a license. You have to prove that you and your company have minimum capitalization. So you have to prove that you have, say, $1 million in net worth as a company before you're allowed to do it. And so it's a rules-based regime. And this is part of the issue, is that the rules are different in every state, subtly. So it's going to be very difficult to figure out exactly what your total compliance obligations are across all of the states. And that leads me to the fourth characteristic of all of these money transmission statutes, which is that they're non-uniform on balance. The Uniform Law Commission, which is a body of legal academics that tries to work towards having unified state laws, they issued a Uniform Money Services Act, which would be like the money transmission law for every state, ideally, back in 2000. Now, unfortunately, 18 years on, that model act has only been adopted by, I believe, 12 states. I may have that number wrong because I'm not looking at my report right now. So not a great win, basically, for the ULC or for uniformity. And in every other state, you basically find sort of bespoke fashioned definitions for all sorts of essential terms and different regulatory requirements. Although they're all relatively similar, they're just slightly different drafted. And so one of the big issues here is, for example, the definition of money transmission, which is a very important definition in the law, because if you're starting a new company, you're starting an innovative business, you do some payments, you want to know whether you're going to need licenses or not. There's no one definition of money transmission you can read to determine whether you're going to need licenses or not. You have to read, or rather pay a very expensive lawyer to read, 53 state and territorial definitions. Now, 12 of those are all the Uniform Money Services Act, but all the rest are pretty much unique, which means it's very complicated, especially if you're a type of business that's not quite clearly a money transmitter. It's sort of up in the air, which we'll talk about in a moment. So a quick note on what we're not talking about in this paper. We're not talking about giving bank charters to money transmitters. So some of you may be familiar with the FinTech Charter Initiative at the federal regulator of banks, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Banks do a lot more than just custody and transmission. They lend out money. They play a role in the actual creation of currency. They play this public role. And that's why they have heavier duty regulations. And banks can, of course, be regulated at the federal or the state level. You can have a federal charter from the OCC, or you can have a state charter from the banking regulator in, say, Nevada. Unlike that dual banking system, there is no dual money transmission licensing system. You can't get a federal license. You have to get 53 state and territorial licenses. And those licenses are lighter in compliance obligations than being a chartered bank, of course, and you're less limited in what you're allowed to do. But they're certainly not easy to comply with, and it's not cheap. We're also not talking in this paper about anti-money laundering policy. Anti-money laundering policy, i.e. money transmitters and financial institutions have to collect information on their customers, have to stop the illicit flow of funds when they flow through their organizations, those laws are not enforced state by state. I mean, they are enforced state by state, but the policies are set by the federal regulator who's on point, which is FinCEN, a division of the U.S. Treasury. And so you don't have this problem of different standards state by state with respect to anti-money laundering issues. And we're not talking about changing anything with respect to AML. We're just talking about the licenses. So who are all these money transmitters that we're talking about? Well, they're companies that provide payments-related services and are highly networked. You don't want to sign up for money transmission services from a company that will only let you send money to five people. You want a networked company that will let you send money to just about anybody. That's just the nature of the business and the business that companies want to provide and customers want to consume. These businesses are interstate because they want to be highly networked. They want to have global markets. For example, Coinbase, as of October 2017, some research had at least 11.7 million users, which is more than Charles Schwab, the brokerage, the online brokerage firm. And that's probably gotten bigger because in the intervening period since that research was done in October, Coinbase became the number one app on the iOS App Store. So who knows how big that number is now. These are companies with lots of customers all over the country and all over the world. Western Union would only work, of course, if you could send money to anywhere in the world. It wouldn't work if you could only send to customers in one state. So they're interstate businesses. They're also novel businesses. So it's not just Western unions that are money transmitters, as I started to describe earlier. It's also potentially Bitcoin exchanges like Coinbase. And it doesn't just stop there. It's also potentially sharing economy startups and tech companies like Airbnb and Uber that do payments between the people who drive people and the people who get driven, or the people who rent a home and the people who put their home up for rent on Airbnb. And it's kind of strange, you might say. Those don't seem like money transmitters, but the laws are drafted so broadly that in many states, those tech companies in the sharing economy are also included. Also included can be device manufacturers and hardware companies like Apple and Google because of Apple Pay and Google Pay. And so note that for a lot of these companies, it's not clear that they're money transmitters under the definitions, and every state has a different definition, and every regulator in every state has some discretion to interpret the definition more or less broadly. So you're starting to get a picture that if you're an Apple or an Airbnb or a Coinbase and you're not sure whether you're a money transmitter, you're going to have a huge pain in the butt trying to figure out what your obligations are. And by the way, the penalties for being an unlicensed money transmitter, both state and federal, because of the Bank Secrecy Act, are extreme. It's 5 years in jail. It's a felony criminal conviction. And it can be liabilities that extend not just to the company, but to the investors in the company, to the employees of the company. It's really serious to be an unlicensed money transmitter. So you might say, well, move fast and break things. Ask for forgiveness, not permission. It's not exactly the same in the context of running a payment startup as it was in the context of running something like Uber. The downside risk of failure to comply is really much more grave. So this is a huge problem. Now, cognizant of the fact that this is a Federalist Society organized event, I know I'm talking basically about the potential for federal preemption, for making a federal regime that would replace this costly and inefficient state regime. So I urge you to look at our report, because we go through a lot of, I think, usually excellent counterarguments. We go through a lot of usually excellent arguments that say, no, the states should be on point with respect to these regulations. We shouldn't have the federal government doing it. And the biggest one, of course, is what Brandeis called the states as laboratories approach, that we should have experimentation state by state so that bad policies don't, like a contagion, spread across the entire country. And then there's also this idea that states can compete, of course. We call it TIBU competition, after the economic researcher who came up with the idea, where we think that, you know, if every state has unique policies, they'll kind of fight with each other in order to get more businesses to locate in their state. And the paradigmatic example of this is Delaware corporate law. And that's why so many corporations want to put their corporate headquarters in Delaware, because Delaware competed with all the other states and came out with the best corporate law. Now, some people say that it's actually a race to the bottom, and Delaware just came out with the corporate law that creates the most negative externalities for consumers. I don't think we need to even get into that debate about state money transmission licensing, because that states as laboratories approach and that competition approach doesn't apply to money transmission, because again, the businesses are interstate and networked, and the laws are permission-based and extraterritorial. So you're going to have to get a license in every state where you have customers, and each may interpret your requirements independently and different. Now, this is not unique to money transmission. Thomas Hazlett of Clemens University has studied telecommunications networks and state-by-state regulation, and we cite his research pretty extensively in the paper. Hazlett says it very clearly why the states as laboratories approach doesn't work, and I just want to read a quote from his work in telecommunications regulation. Hazlett writes, "Firms adjust to diverse regulations by conforming to those rules that allow for the best aggregate operations. When integrated national networks are key, both to suppliers who seek scale economies and to consumers who desire nationwide coverage, the competition between the states results not in diverse standards, but winner take all. And the winner is the state with the most restrictive regulations. In situations where state regulations contradict each other, even an effort to smooth out differences in state laws will be stymied, and the costs of balkanization will increase further." So the bottom line is, we don't have experimentation in this area because you'll have to comply with all state laws. And we don't have competition because a state being friendly to blockchain or Bitcoin isn't going to be much of a benefit if all the other states don't go along, because the company will still have to comply with the more restrictive state laws as well. And, you know, so I went to law school at NYU and was lucky enough to have an amazing man and legal scholar, Richard Epstein, as a professor. And Epstein is certainly no friend of federal preemption. He's definitely, you know, an advocate for state-by-state decision-making. But Epstein writes also about networked businesses and state-by-state regulation, and says that it doesn't make sense. So I want to read this other quote by Richard Epstein, especially for FedSoc listeners who might, you know, be fans. "There are certain transactions in which an individual or firm cannot choose among the states, but must enlist the cooperation of all states in order to carry on its business." And Epstein continues that these transactions are one of three types of situations in which federalism provides insufficient protection for market institutions. "It is quite possible," says Epstein, "that the sum total of the regulatory demands will exceed the gains from running the business, so that the competition of federalism becomes the destroyer and not the protector of markets." And I think that's exactly what we see with respect to innovative payments companies. It's just too expensive to start one in the U.S., and so people won't even try. And the reason why it's expensive is because you need to solicit cooperation from 53 independent regulators. So there's a lot more in our paper, but I want to say this. The inefficiencies of this system do a few things. They prevent effective regulatory cooperation between licensing authorities and anti-money laundering or investor protection regulators. So the fact that there's 53 states doing the licensing makes it hard for the anti-money laundering regulator and the federal government to have a single point of contact. Makes it hard for the investor protection regulators like the CFTC or the SEC to understand exactly how the companies that are exchanging digital currencies are being regulated. These inefficiencies also hinder economic growth because they raise the cost of starting innovative businesses. These inefficiencies hinder American competitiveness in financial technology because there are regimes internationally that do not have overlapping multi-state licensing, like the EU, where they have a passporting system. You get one license in one EU nation, you can passport to the rest. These inefficiencies hinder effective consumer protection efforts because regulators don't calibrate their protections based on the activities of the business as a whole, only calibrate these activities or calibrate their regulations based on the activities of the business with customers in the state. And these inefficiencies hinder financial inclusion, quite frankly, because their costs stymie the development of new financial tools that could deliver cheaper, safer, or more palatable services to underserved communities. So the long and short of it is that we're pretty long overdue in the U.S. for a solution to the challenges of state-by-state licensing. And what we need is a form of sensible, unified national regulation for money transmitters, effectively. And in our paper, we detail four possible solutions. And I'm going to just mention them briefly. We can discuss them more in the Q&A. So the first possible solution is the least extensive, the least invasive, changes the least things. And that's the creation of a licensed passporting system that resembles the European Union's e-money system. States would be told to honor the licenses offered by other states. Maybe the federal government would play a role in setting a minimum standard of what all state licenses should look like. The second option is the creation of a federally administered alternative license and limited preemption of state law for those who get that federal license. So states would still be allowed to give licenses, but a company, if they wanted, could go to a federal regulator, get a single federal license, and then they wouldn't have to comply with state-by-state license requirements. The third option is the creation of a federally administered license and full preemption of all state money transmission licensing. Just wipe it out and say, now the federal government is the preeminent and sole regulator of money transmission. And the fourth option is a bit more specific to digital currencies. And we added to the report, honestly, fairly recently, in light of the interest from investor protection regulators in the federal government, like the SEC and the CFTC. And this option is this. Maybe we create a more comprehensive CFTC-run investor protection regime that's focused on digital currency exchanges. And that regime would do more than just the normal, sorry for the car horns outside if you guys can hear that. That regime would do more than just do the consumer protection things that money transmission regulators do, i.e. make sure that if someone says they're holding your Bitcoins, they're holding your Bitcoins. It would also have some sort of market supervisory functions built into it so that we know that the trading going on the platform isn't subject to manipulation or insider trading, kind of what the CFTC does with, say, a derivatives clearing organization, their supervisory approach to those exchanges. And so maybe if the CFTC is interested in doing more investor protection, we should trade that higher compliance burden for exchanges for a lower compliance burden, i.e. federal preemption of state money transmission licensing. And all of these approaches, all of these four approaches, they need to have two more things, I think. And we write a lot about this in the paper. The first thing is they have to have a federal safe harbor for novel businesses that do not create the sort of risks to consumers that money transmission licensing is meant to address. So recall that these statutes are drafted broadly, and a lot of things that aren't actually money transmission can qualify under a broadly interpreted statute. We need a federal safe harbor that makes sure that certain businesses that don't create risk to consumers are never subject to these state-by-state laws, to rationalize the cutoff point at the bottom of state money transmission licensing. So we need that safe harbor no matter what approach we take. And I think we should also contemplate the creation of a sandbox program where a novel business that would fit into the requirement for needing a license can go to either a federal or a state regulator and negotiate for flexible regulatory treatment. Say, this is what our business does. If we obey by these conditions, can we avoid having a full license but still operate? And that, as I said, could either be federally administered or state administered, and we'd need to make sure that all states honor that sandbox arrangement such that if you get the sandbox arrangement, you are not still liable for getting licenses in all 53 states and territories. So I know I just kind of brain dumped a lot, and I promised I wouldn't go over 20 minutes. Obviously, there's a lot in this paper, and I'm pretty excited about it, so I'm going to shut up now and take questions.
Well, thanks, Peter. That wasn't bad at all. That was a great survey, and I think that's going to be helpful in our to start our Q&A off. So let's go to questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating the floor mode's been turned on. After that, to request the floor, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'll open the floor now. Okay, the floor request mode is on. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We'll answer all the questions in the order in which they're received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our first question, I'd like to make an announcement. This is the final notice that on Friday this week, February 2nd, the RTP is co-hosting the 14th Annual Journal of Law, Economics, and Policy Symposium at the George Mason University Law School. We'll start with breakfast and check in at 8 a.m., enjoy a lunch and keynote with Philip K. Howard, and close with a reception starting at 6:30. The topic is regulatory reform, transparency, and the American economy, and it's going to feature RTP paper presentations by the experts who wrote them, such as Ambassador Borden Gray, Chuck Cooper, and Clark Neely. The symposium is open to the public, and you can register free of charge at the GMU Law and Economics Center website. Okay, we have a question. If anyone else has a question, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you in turn.
Hi, Peter. This is Mary Beth Buchanan from Bryan Cave. Thank you so much for doing this presentation. My question, and I missed the first few minutes, I think that all of the three solutions that you've come up with would each be better than the current environment that we have right now. Do you have any indication that the OCC is going to go along with something like this? And if so, what is the feedback that you're hearing from the states to see whether they would be willing to accept more of a federal presence here as opposed to the individual state regulators?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks, Mary Beth. So, a few things. Right now, I don't believe any agency, the OCC included, has the statutory authority to create through regulation a federal alternative license or to direct the states to accept reciprocally their own licenses. So I don't believe, from a pure constitutional standpoint and administrative law standpoint, that this can be done without federal legislation, which means that this is, in some ways, a pipe dream. Now, I think I'm actually getting much more optimistic, much more quickly. But companies like Western Union or PayPal have wanted federal preemption for a long time, and it hasn't happened. And I think that speaks more to just the natural inertia of the legislative process. Now, given that it would have to be done through legislation, and I don't mean to sound crass, it wouldn't matter what the states say, other than the fact that they lobby their congressmen and would ask them not to pass this law. And that's because, of course, federal law preempts state law. So if you've got a clear piece of law from Congress that says that this regime is now law, any conflicting laws of the states would be preempted. That's under the 10th Amendment, of course. And then finally, what do I think the state response would be? I'm sure some will recognize the I think, hard to argue with economic issues inherent in the state-by-state approach and may rationally come to grips with this and say, like, look, this makes sense. And especially if we're still allowed to license companies along with the federal government, this is not a bad thing. It's good for competition. It's good for businesses. It's good for consumers on the whole. Competition works. We're happy. But there will be states who don't like this, who see that it's the federal government trampling over their power. And we've seen that with the OCC's fintech charter, where they started suggesting that they would offer national bank charters to companies that do payments and lending but don't do deposit taking. So it starts to impede on state territory with respect to money transmission, albeit you'll have to get a charter, which is hard, rather than just a license, which might be easier. And what we saw was that the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, which is sort of an interstate organization that the regulators belong to, sued the OCC, saying you don't have the statutory authority under the National Bank Act to do this. And the New York Department of Financial Services, one of these state regulators, sued the OCC as well. Now, I don't think those lawsuits actually are likely to succeed because the OCC has Chevron deference over how its laws are interpreted, and that means that they can interpret them how they want, basically, and they probably do have the authority they claim to have under the National Bank Act. But that's the fintech charter, which would be different than the money transmission license, which would, again, require, I think, an act of Congress.
So, Peter, for those of us who represent clients in this industry, would you suggest that we focus our efforts in trying to educate the Ag Committee with respect to a CFTC role? Or is there another committee that you think also could use some education?
Yeah, I think the Ag Committee is definitely one committee that should take interest in this, because as we described, our fourth option is maybe this is something that comes along with some light market supervisory framework as well and is administered by the CFTC, which the Ag Committee is the committee of jurisdiction, of oversight rather, for the CFTC. I would also say the Banking Committee and the Financial Services Committees in both the Senate and the House are going to play a role here. We've got a lot of education to do. It's what CoinCenter's focused on since 2014, is trying to educate people in Congress about why Bitcoin and digital currencies are real innovations and why, for one thing, state money transmission licensing is a real impediment. And we'll need a lot of momentum to push something like this through. But I think it's one of the most exciting and most worthwhile fights that we could fight in Congress. And I don't think it's partisan either, which is kind of neat.
Yep, I agree. Thank you.
Thanks again for the question.
Thanks, Mary Beth.
And great response, Peter. I'm going to remind everyone on the call, if you have a question, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We've got at least another question left, but I want to make another announcement before we get to our next question, and that is that everyone please mark your calendars because on Thursday next week, February 8th at 12 o'clock noon, we will hold a free lunch podcast with Naomi Rao, the current administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Administrator Rao will reflect on the performance of regulatory agencies over the past year and give her thoughts on what we might expect going forward. Again, mark your calendars. That's next week on Thursday, February 8th at 12 o'clock noon on the Free Lunch Podcast. Okay, we'll go to our next question now.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and you actually just answered my question in your closing statement, which was about partisanship. I used to work in the Senate, and I know, you know, if an issue is bipartisan, it has a significantly greater chance of passing versus if it's a very partisan issue. So my question was more, in your experience, do you see one party versus the other favoring legislation that you're suggesting?
So I don't think it's particularly partisan at all. And, you know, in our work at Coin Center, going office to office explaining Bitcoin, we've found real believers and people who are excited about the technology who are Republicans and who are Democrats. And we've also found people who think that it's the worst thing that's ever happened on both sides. And usually we're able also to talk them down from that and maybe help them understand some of the benefits. So I don't think digital currencies are partisan. Money transmission licensing, I don't think is all that partisan, other than to say that if we were to make sweeping generalizations about Republicans and Democrats and say that Republicans are on average more in favor of competition and markets, and Democrats are often more concerned with consumer protection and what markets can do to vulnerable populations, this should be a no-brainer for both. So I think I've laid out the case for why the inefficiencies of the state-by-state money transmission framework destroy market competition. They make it incredibly hard for new businesses to enter and offer unique payment solutions to customers. Now, that should also be palatable to a Democrat, though, because the other thing that basically you see as a failure of state-by-state money transmission licensing is effective consumer protection. So I hate to always pick on Alabama, but I always pick on Alabama because in order to get licensed in Alabama, you only need to prove that you have a $5,000 bond with the government to support customers in Alabama. Now, that's a tiny amount of money compared to the amount of business that PayPal or Venmo or Coinbase do. And I think Alabama probably just, you know, hasn't updated their money transmission licensing statute in a long time. And so the long and short of it is we could have much better consumer protections as well if we had a unified, sensible approach. And also, if we make the sweeping generalization that Democrats might be more concerned with financial inclusion, although I don't think that's a good generalization to make. I think Republicans care about financial inclusion too. But if we were to make that generalization, I think this would be very good for financial inclusion. The various organizations within the World Bank that we cite in our paper have identified the regulatory mess in the United States as one of the impediments of having more vibrant startups offering more palatable and low-cost products to underserved populations. So if we can clean that mess up, I think we can get more people with access to financial services, and that's incredibly important, no matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Peter.
I wanted to say one more thing about Mary Beth's question. She said, which committees? The reason why I brought up the Banking Committee in addition to, say, the Ag Committee is in part because there will be a hearing next Tuesday before the Banking Committee where Chairman Giancarlo and Chairman Clayton of the SEC and or the CFTC and SEC respectively will testify about cryptocurrencies. And this is exactly the kind of regulatory issue that I think they're concerned with. I think in their op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, as I said in the start of this teleforum, says that maybe the state-by-state licensing regime needs a revisit. So that's another very relevant committee.
Well, thanks again, Mary Beth. Okay, Peter, we're going to go to our next question. If anyone else has a question, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll put you in the queue.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for this very interesting presentation. I know you're pursuing a federal remedy, and which I assume will take some time. In the meantime, I'm interested in opportunities for states to pursue reciprocity provisions, some states or all states. And I know the European Union has a passporting regime where an entity licensed in one country can operate in another country. Are you familiar with that regime, and is that a model that states might use within the U.S.?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks. It's an excellent question. So we do discuss in our report the European Union's e-money licensing regime, which is a passporting regime. Now, I think it's an excellent regime. I would like to note, and I don't even know if we actually note this in the paper, it only applies to businesses that are transmitting state currencies like euros. It doesn't apply to digital currency businesses at the moment, and it'd be really great if it did. But that's neither here nor there, because we want to talk about money transmission licensing in general, not just digital currency stuff. I'd say that it's a great model. It still allows for local expertise and some varying approaches nation by nation, or if it was in the U.S. state by state, and it doesn't trample on state jurisdiction as much as full federal preemption would. But I don't think it can be done by the states on their own. So the reason why it works in the EU is that there's an EU directive on e-money that was passed from the central authority in the European Union and mandates that all member nations will honor the e-money licenses of other member nations, that mandates that all member nations cannot add different conditions or restrictions on out-of-nation licensees, and cannot conduct independent examinations into the books of the licensees. So, because if they could, of course, that would be the end of the usefulness of the system. You have a license in France, but Germany is still demanding access to your books time to time, and so is Belgium, and so is the UK until they leave. So that simply doesn't work. Now, we could imagine the states, some core number of states that really care about this issue, getting together and creating a multi-state compact where they promise to honor the licenses of the other states in the compact. But you said that federal legislation is a slow process, and you're absolutely right. I think a multi-state compact amongst enough states for it to be useful would also be a very slow and difficult process. I was going to do some extra research, but the paper is long enough as it is into what are the largest multi-state compacts. I think there are a few that are all states, but they're usually about much less controversial subject matter, like we all like the flag or something like that, you know.
Thank you for the question, and thanks, Peter, for the response. Peter, I'm not sure exactly you got specifically to this point, but you mentioned in your remarks that there are potential solutions that would create quote-unquote fintech sandboxes, and I know that Arizona has a model like that. Is that something that – what do you think about the Arizona model, I guess, is my question.
So I love this idea in general of sandboxes, and I think the Arizona, from what I've seen of it, the Arizona proposal is good. I think it's more of almost like a safe harbor in the case of Arizona, wherein as long as you don't, operate beyond a certain scope, amount of money and customers, you're not subject to the laws. And I think that's very important because right now there's no cutoff for a money transmitter. If you transmit $1 on behalf of a friend of yours to another friend, and you do it kind of as a business, like you took a fee for it, and query what business means. Maybe you're just a sole proprietor. You are technically in violation of the law. So having a lower cutoff and some freedom to innovate, like a sandbox for smaller companies, I think is great. But my issue with that Arizona approach is the same as what we were just discussing with respect to the possibility of state-by-state reciprocity for other licenses. Unless you can get all the other states to honor that sandbox agreement and to say, we won't demand a license from that company because they're subject to that sandbox agreement with Arizona, it's not going to be of tremendous benefit to the company. The company, because they're running a networked business that necessarily is online and has customers all over the world, will still have all of these huge compliance costs in all the other 52 states and territories, as well as internationally. And I'm sure they'd love to just have a simpler approach in one of their states, but it is a marginal improvement and not a radical improvement. And I think we need a radical improvement at this point if America is going to stay competitive in financial technology.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter, for answering my question. I don't see any other questions queued up currently, so I'm going to ask Peter, if you have any final remarks after I make one final call for questions to our audience. So, again, anyone who's listening who has a question for Peter, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to your question before we hear final remarks from Peter. Okay. Looks like I'll have the pleasure of having teed up the last question for you, Peter. Do you have any final remarks on this topic for our audience?
So I just want to reiterate the difference between these licenses and bank charters, because we've had a dual banking system in the U.S. for a long time. You can get a charter from Illinois to be a bank, and you can get a charter from the OCC to be a national bank. That's a heavy-duty type of regulation. We only give bank charters to companies that agree to really restrict their activities, because it's sort of a quid pro quo. It's an exchange for saying, look, you're getting the very important public function of participating in the fractional reserve economic system of giving out money and loans. And in return, we need to make sure you don't involve yourself in really risky lines of business, like potentially digital currencies, although that's not actually clear. Banks might be able to deal in digital currencies. But that's a heavy-duty type of regulation. Your charter limits the activities you're allowed to do. With respect to payments, we're talking about something much simpler. You know, PayPal doesn't play a public role or function with respect to the currency, to money. They take money from one person, hold it one-to-one. They're not allowed to go and lend it out to other people. They're not allowed to invest it in the stock market. They're just holding it until the person who gave it to them directs them to either give it back to them or to give it to another PayPal customer. And the same with Coinbase. They hold a Bitcoin for a person, and the person directs them to give it to somebody else or to give it back to them. They are not creating the kind of systemic risks that banks do. It's much different. And I think that's why we've seen this lighter touch, state-administered regime evolve as opposed to this heavy-duty chartering system that's both state and federal. Now, I think I've laid out pretty lucidly why the state-by-state regime, even though it's light touch in any particular state, is no longer light touch in general, because light touch times 53 states and territories is a heavy touch, an unwanted touch, if you will. And there is no federal equivalent like there is in the banking context. So we really have this weird situation where banks, which create much more risk in the economy because they're involved in lending and fractional reserve and things like that, actually have a more friendly regulatory regime than the lowly payment companies, who also, by the way, tend to be the innovators. Not to, you know, criticize banks too much, but they're risk averse, and partially they're risk averse because their regulators don't want to see them messing around with the public functions they perform. And so it's always been the payment providers that have been innovative. It started out, and I don't mean just the internet companies, it started out with the telecommunications companies, like telegraph companies. Western Union was the original IT company, not internet technology, but telecommunications technology with telegrams. And they also became the dominant money transmitter for a time. And now more recently, you see companies that have real network effects on the internet getting into money transmission, basically. So the dominant smartphone manufacturers like Apple and Google develop Apple Pay and Google Pay. Alipay, which is the dominant way of moving money around in China, comes from the big web portal and search engine company in China, Alibaba. PayPal comes from eBay, a site that allows buyers and sellers of used goods to meet and exchange. They become a dominant online money transmitter, PayPal, and they spin the company off from eBay. And now with digital currencies, you know, these companies, again, they're not doing lending, they're not doing deposit taking, they're just holding people's digital currency, which is, I think, a really important innovation for payments, for reducing the cost of payments. And I think it's just excellent that they feel comfortable wading into these new and innovative waters. And I think that that's awesome and will lead to much better consumer welfare and much more competition and much better markets and much better everything. Of course, I work at Coin Center. So, of course, I feel that way. And yet, again, I know I'm kind of rambling here. I'm hoping someone thought up a question in this time. We treat those companies more harshly in some ways than we treat banks, because you have to get 53 state and territorial licenses. And especially if you're an innovative company that does something with the Bitcoin, to put it in a funny way, you're going to have to go explain the Bitcoin to 53 state and territorial regulators who probably don't have a technological background. They're probably very sharp with respect to the law, but good luck. Good luck.
Peter, thank you so much for those final remarks, and we've given our audience a lot to ruminate on, and I think that's where we'll leave it. But I want to say thank you to you, and as always, thank you, our audience, for joining us today on the Free Lunch Podcast. Hope to see all of you at Friday's symposium, or to have you join us again next week when we host our next Free Lunch Podcast call with Administrator Naomi Rao. But until then, so long, everyone. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.